Well, I've wanted to talk to you over the years. When the Friday book came out, I wanted to talk to you then, and when Tidewater Tales, but somehow we were never able to arrange it, so I'm delighted that I have this opportunity. Did you say that this was actually your first book tour?
My maiden book tour. It's not my maiden book by any means, but and some of my more successful ex-students are old hands at book tours, Louise Erdrich and people of that sort.
She has a new book about to come
coming
out.
Coming out, yes, a Columbus book. Yeah. That's right. And so she was able to give her old coach a couple of hints about how this sort of thing is done, as well as some encouragement. It's been, needless to say, an interesting experience for me. It reminds me, A, of my old jazz musician days. I feel as though I'm on the road again, and that's a mixed feeling indeed. But as I had been warned by Erdrich and by my people at Little Brown and so forth, one of the pleasures of the otherwise rather exhausting experience is that you get to see these wonderful bookstores and this rather new phenomenon of almost back-to-back readings in some of those great bookstores, sometimes almost one a night in certain cities. So not only are the bookstores themselves a kind of rare and wonderful and I had thought perhaps endangered species, which one should do all one can for, but they have become, in some cities at least, they're a little the way Endicott and some others have always been here in New York, centers of, or kind of centers of what remains of our literary culture insofar as it's a face-to-face matter. That's been a pleasure indeed.
Yeah. When you were in New York studying at Juilliard in the 50s, there were still perhaps two dozen secondhand bookstores down around 4th Avenue. And the Pageant is still there, although it's moved, and the Strand is still there. That's it.
The Strand is still.
The Strand is still there, but it's not so much fun to shop at the Strand. It's so big and it's so crowded. Have you been there?
No, but of course literature itself is a little like that. Its halls go on a long way in all directions. And the difference, obviously, between those great old second-hand bookstores and the kind of new or all-service bookstores that have these readings is the difference between the printed literary culture as it really is, that is something that doesn't involve personal transactions between the author and his audience, and something that I happen to have a fondness for, the oral narrative tradition. You rather feel when you're going into these houses of print, but reading to not only a living audience, but a live audience, so different from what we do in our normal practice as writers, that there is that interchange, that coaxial connection between the teller and the told, between the author and the listener, speaker and the listener in this case, which characterized literature for millennia before print came along. And I rather like that aspect of it.
And being a teacher, you're probably very good at meeting people and having readings. Teacher is in effect a person who does go on the stage.
Yes, though we don't like to think of university education as showbiz. I suspect it has a showbiz aspect. And for a long time, and currently, though my connection with university life is a little attenuated from what it had been in the past, I'm sort of more or less retired. My job has been coaching hot young writers, and that's not quite the same thing as lecturing. I mean, that is much more of a two-way transaction than it was back in the days when I actually lectured on literature to classrooms full of people. University life is a phenomenon that I have an affection for. I've enjoyed working in universities. I've never felt that I was in any danger of becoming an academic writer just because the academy paid my living. American universities are so diverse and raffish in a way and democratic that I think if we look at those of my contemporaries, those of our American writers who've paid the rent mainly by working in universities, the last thing that could be said of them as a group is that they have become hothouse or academic writers just because they've been working in. We think of people like Harry Cruz, for example, and Saul Bellow and the rest. They may be academics in the case of Bellow. He's a genuine intellectual, but he's certainly not an academic writer in the pejorative sense of that term.
No, I was talking to Harry Cruz just a couple of months ago, who's sitting right where you're sitting, and he says he's never lost his roots. he's still a cotton picker, and he talked like one, but he's a... Wow, what an intelligent mind, and what a dynamic speaker. I mean, he must hold his classes spellbound.
I dare say he does. That may be the oral narrative tradition coming through his roots there.
Well, he talks the way he sounds on the page.
And universities are sweet places. I mean, there is where, as John Gardner said so eloquently in one of his posthumously published works of nonfiction, that's where literature still lives a kind of life of its own. And for a young writer, and sometimes a not-so-young writer, to be taken by the hand by a wiser guide through the corridors of his predecessors, this is my language now, not Gardner's, can be an instructive thing indeed. I certainly found it so, though many of my most important discoveries of my predecessors were not matters of curriculum, but were stumbled upon extracurricularly from filing books in the library stacks. I try to remind the young writers whom I coach that they, if they need reminding, that they're joining a conversation that's been going on for 4,500 years, and the inventory of effects after that many writers, we're talking now about writing, not just about storytelling, which of course goes on for millennia beyond that, the inventory of effects by the writers over all those hundreds of generations is very large. The whole notion of what is a story? How do you go about a love story? Is love what you ought to write about? You know, what do we mean by beginning, middle, and end? Why do we think that our own lives have a dramatic curve? Do we think that because we've read so many stories, or are stories that way because life really has a dramatic curve? These are lovely things, I think, for some kinds of writers to contemplate. Some find it intimidating. They may have the feeling that, as the Romantics had, that it's all been done, that you know, there's not much else left for us next generations to do. But more, I think, find, as I found, that it's just encouraging. It makes you feel a little less lonely to know that people are trying to say new things about the sea and the dawn. Homer probably had it easier all those millennia ago, getting there early in the tradition.
I know what you're saying, and you have, I think, made an effort to try to express yourself in different ways. And yet, I also have a feeling that almost everything we write is based on that which has been written before.
Cézanne makes a wonderful statement that I love to quote, speaking to what exactly the point you're making, only vis-a-vis painting in this case instead of literature. Cézanne says that the road to the Louvre leads through nature, and the road to nature leads through the Louvre. I think painters often learn how to paint nature by looking at what other painters have done. Writers often learn what a story is and what their aesthetic presumptions are going to be, whether they think in those terms or not, by the stories they've assimilated at the same time. So you can say perhaps that the road to life for a writer may lead through the library, but eventually the road to the library, that is the shelf with his or her books on it, has got to lead through life, or else it's just books about books, which is not what most of us want to do.
Well, there are two elements to what you're talking about, too, I believe. One is the story, and the other is the language. And your language, for example, I believe it actually started with the sabbatical, where you spoke in a dual language, or as two. And I think this was carried through to Tidewater Tales.
Yes.
And also in The Last Voyage of Somebody the Sailor, only there's a dual voice there. I have a feeling the Baylor's second voice is that of his dead twin, Bijou. Am I correct?
I suspect so, too. the two earlier novels you mentioned are done in a point of view that I invented. It's very hard to do anything new in a medium that's as old as 4,500 years. But this first-person couple point of view, not a first-person plural, but a first-person dual point of view that I used in Sabbatical and in Tidewater Tales, the couple speaking as we, but then referring to either one of them in the third person by his or her name. I really think that hadn't been done before in literature.
I never saw it done before.
I'm proud of that device.
I'm an inveterate reader. No, this was new when I read Sabbatical. It was a new experience, and I marveled at the effort.
The echo of that, as you accurately point out, in The Last Voyage of Somebody the Sailor, is an offshoot of two things. The first, that I am trying to keep one foot in the here and now and one foot in the long ago and far away. So we've got the adventures of this failing, fading new journalist, Simon William Baylor, who doesn't quite know who he is and therefore is called Somebody in the novel's title, alternating with the adventures of the legendary Sinbad as the two threads of the Argyle sock. Can you make an Argyle sock out of two threads? As these two threads of the Argyle sock knit themselves together. But Baylor is, as you correctly point out, the surviving half of a pair of opposite-sex twins whose twin did not survive birth, and so no doubt feels a kind of as though he, perhaps part of his identity problem, his ontological agnosticism, as I think of it, may come from that sense that he's only half a person, that he's not quite a whole person. This is a theme, as I don't have to tell you, Don, that runs through much literature and mythology. If we think of Aristophanes in Plato's Symposium saying that we're all, each of us, the fallen half of some once complete union. It's a mood, I think, that almost any of us is capable of feeling in certain weathers. But those of us who, not to imply that any of the book is autobiographical, but it does happen to be a matter of historical accident or circumstance that I myself am half of a pair of opposite-sex twins. My sister, happily not defunct, she survived page 43, as Baylor's infant sister did not. We twins know that for a fact, you know, from our earliest days, that we really are a unit that consists of more than our individual selves. If we're not psychopathological, we lose that feeling as we mature and we become individuals. But perhaps with that ancient memory, I like to imagine anyway, of how it was in the womb before language was, or when we were early born, before language was there at all, when we had company. You know, the rest of you guys who weren't twins were very lonely back there, I presume, in the womb and just after. But those who were together even before birth and who were communicating even before language are likely to have, especially if they turn out to be writers, a kind of spooky sense of the emblematic possibilities of that condition. I certainly do. As some critic pointed out, my books tend to come in pairs.
Your sister is... tell me a little bit about her. Does she have your... she probably has some of your physical characteristics.
She is of the opposite sex from myself,
true.
Being an opposite
true.
Sex.
True, but in terms of creativity and demeanor and so forth, is she similar?
I don't think... as you know, opposite sex twins are, as they say, dizygotic. Fraternal is a funny kind of word when one's a boy and one's a girl. But they come from different eggs, and so their genetic composition is no more similar than any pair of siblings. And in the case of my sister and myself, that would apply to physical resemblance. She's rather short. I'm rather tall. Mm. As soon as we discovered that she was a little girl and I was a little boy, we started going off in different directions with our own friends. And, of course, at puberty, when the hormones kick in, then we really went in different directions. Our careers have followed different paths. My life has had a rather wide radius, but perhaps not as much geographical depth. She has remained back in the home territory of Tidewater, Maryland, and so I think.
Well, you haven't gone too far from that territory.
Well, here I am.
Either literally and in your fiction. Well, back to the book.
Yes.
Which is the primary reason that you're here. You've had I could tell this in reading the Friday book. You've had a long-running interest in Scheherazade.
Very much so.
The 1001 Nights. How did this develop your interest, almost an obsession?
I think it's fair enough to say it's an obsession. It's a preoccupation that borders upon obsession anyway, and one which I have book after book, simply because one doesn't want to repeat oneself, been attempting to purge from my imagination by writing the final version of what I have to say about Scheherazade. But like many a great image, and she is one of the profoundest in my personal pantheon, there are four great images in the whole history of literature that are the northeast, south, and west of my own imagination, of which Scheherazade is one. I first discovered her putting those books back on the shelf in the library of Johns Hopkins University when I was an undergraduate. She was not on any reading list. I think The 1001 Nights is still rarely to be found on university reading lists just because it belongs to the Islamic tradition and not to the Western tradition. But there she was on the book stack, on the book cart being shelved along with the great Sanskrit epics and the Panchatantra, the ocean of story, all those things that Salman Rushdie was raised on, but most of the rest of us were not. First reading, I fell in love with that figure as the primordial or a primordial image of the storyteller's condition for obvious reasons. Her life depends on her narrative production. And like all of us who are professionals, it's never enough to have told several good stories, even 897 good stories. You're only as good as your next story. There is no tenure in the world of living art. A writer might establish him or herself and rest on his or her laurels, even if his or her talent fails. But in fact, when the audience stops paying attention, you're dead, and that's Scheherazade's literal condition. It's to be noted at the same time that that frightening relationship with her audience, which is also an erotic relationship, is a very productive one. She tells a lot of stories with her life on the line. I like that idea that it is a fertilizing, and she bears children by the king at the same time. It's a wonderful feminist allegory, it goes without saying. She's the savior of her sex. She understands that the king's misogyny is a kind of madness that's destructive to the state and must be cured in a fashion such as she cures it. But finally, and I think most important, what I came to understand much later in my own experience with Scheherazade, that the important thing, since few of us are professional writers and not all of us are professional feminists, the most fundamental sense of that image is its equation of narration with living. And I believe it to be simply true that as long as we're interested in telling stories and hearing stories, we're humanly alive. And that when that interest fails, we're dead. You know, how was your life? How was your day? When you hear what happened on the way down to the CBS studios, etc. As long as we're interested in that, we're still alive.
I have a feeling the Sinbad stories are stories that people think they have read but haven't. It's like everybody thinks he has read Frankenstein or Dracula or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Nobody's read it. I mean, they've seen the movies. They've seen the cartoons. I mean, I've never read the Sinbad stories. I just think that I have.
These are images that are larger than their books. They escape from their books.
Yeah, and so because you see them in advertising, and you see parodies and so forth. So they're always the genie. And you always,
same with Scheherazade. Everybody knows who Scheherazade was, but perhaps few people have read The Thousand and One Nights, comparatively speaking. And my God, even in Spain, I mean, you see images of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza everywhere. In fact, very few Spaniards have read through Cervantes' novel, but they all know the image, just as many people know who Pinocchio is from Walt Disney, not having read Carlo Collodi's version or what have you. Sinbad is the Islamic Odysseus. He's the figure around whom gathered all the tales, including sailors' tall tales, of the actual superb exploits of the Arabic navigators in the golden age of Arabic maritime trading from about the 8th century up till about the 11th century, just as mythological stories accreted around the figure of Odysseus in the Hellenic tradition. There are wonderful differences. I mean, Odysseus goes out to fight a war, and then he's trying to get home to his wife, Sinbad, and has become the archetypal image of that, along with his cunning and resourcefulness. Sinbad never goes to sea for any other reason than to get rich. He meets monsters. Every one of his voyages is a disaster. He's a very bad man to sail with because he's always the only survivor. So not the shipmate that you would choose. But these disastrous sorties into the unknown are always ultimately profitable. Every time it's a theme in The Thousand and One Nights that he comes back to Basra and back to Baghdad wealthier than the time before, though neither happier nor more wise. My Sinbad attempts to learn from these experiences, as do we all, and to apply the lessons of each last sortie into the unknown to his next. But as happens in life, and as happens even with the Pentagon, he learns that the next voyage is never exactly like the last voyage, and so the lessons you learn from Voyage 5 won't necessarily save you in Voyage 6. Till finally he learns, as I guess we all do if we survive age 40, that experience teaches us to mistrust her lessons. That's one of his final.
But you're talking about Sinbad, but you're also talking about Simon.
Yes.
And Simon's not the greatest sailor in the world either. And I, you know, the
well, he falls overboard, and that's
well, he falls overboard, almost drowns.
I'm glad you said almost, Don. Some of the reviewers.
Well, he gets his leg caught.
Some of the reviewers said he dies and wakes up.
Oh, yeah, you say it in the book. Something to the effect he dies. I didn't believe you.
it should remain equivocal. That's right. He says, then I died, and the next thing I knew, etc.
Yeah, it caught my eye, but I didn't believe it, so I just carried on. Because you do pull tricks.
I don't know about you, but I have a kind of distaste for all the devices of time travel fiction, and I know them all, I think, and I decided if I really was going to be writing a novel in which used this most ancient of the devices of fantasy, the voyage in time, I was going to do it in a way that had never been done before, or in a way that at least is perfectly ambiguous and inarguable. And of course, as the title of the novel suggests, The Last Voyage of Somebody the Sailor, there is at least one possible route to time travel that we cannot argue with because it can neither be demonstrated nor refuted.
This is, now, with the novel, you blend fantasy and reality. Simon's story could stand alone if you had wanted it to.
Yes, Simon's story, as some reviewers pointed out, is sort of a generic John Updike marital experience combined with the growing up stories, which are a kind of staple of our literature. Sinbad's stories of marvels, of giant birds and islands that are actually whales, are as generic in their way to an audience of Islamic literature and of the literature of the marvelous in general, as are in the American tradition, particularly since the Romantic period, stories of growing up and loss of innocence and so forth. I thought it might be an interesting idea, and it fits some other things I think about literature, to keep one foot in each of those things, to alternate the realistic with the fabulous, with the extra spin on it, that to Sinbad and his friends, the things that Simon Baylor are talking about, ordinary things like automobiles and airplanes and wristwatches and so forth, are harder to swallow than what they're very familiar with, floating islands and giant birds and genies that pop out of bottles and such. One man's realism, as Gabriel Garcia Marquez has said, one man's realism is another man's magic, and as Garcia Marquez says, what you guys call surrealism up here is just ordinary reality down where I come from.
Wristwatch, you mentioned the wristwatch here is kind of a theme that runs all the way through the book, and in fact, down to the little links that were taken out of his
The missing
watch.
Links in the plot, the as links. Well as in the watch, keep, that's right.
Yeah, they keep reappearing, like what is it called, an amulet or something?
Yes,
like
yes,
that?
They don't know wristwatches back in medieval Islam, and so they regard this as a perhaps aphrodisiac amulet, not realizing that time is the great anaphrodisiac that depotentiates everything. But it's not so surprising that in a novel, one of the cardinal themes of which is time, that a wristwatch would be perhaps the key to the whole plot. For poor old Baylor, the lost journalist, he's like E.T. trying to get home, only he's trying to get back to this terrestrial reality that he's familiar with. It becomes something that he clings to and has to have in order to get back. How it works, one should read the novel to find out.
I have a feeling the author of this book also is fascinated by names. I see Baylor starts out as B-E-H-L-E-R, I believe.
Spelled
it becomes
German
Baylor,
right,
which is a pseudonym for
spelled
his work.
Way, right.
And I think when he's in Arabia, it's...
becomes Baylor.
Baylor.
Baylor, because they can't pronounce Baylor, or they don't pronounce Baylor properly. And, of course, his problem is exactly that classical romantic problem, which afflicts many Americans, but many who are not Americans as well, of attaining middle age without being exactly sure who he is. He's been writing under a nom de plume, Baylor, spelled in a way that wasn't his birth name. His parents, when he was little, had urged him, his father, to be somebody. He becomes somebody, but the somebody that he is and the name that he signs to the works that have made him famous don't quite remind him of himself. So he's in that, while he's trying to find, to resail the voyages of Sinbad, he's also in pursuit of that classic quest for himself, which is a staple of literature, at least since the Romantic period.
Well, before your readers get too frightened at the fantasy elements, and a lot of people do, you know, there is a lot of reality in the book. In fact, there are a lot of realistic John Barth touches, the growing up in the Eastern Shore, the deaf father. I believe your own father had a hearing problem,
hearing impaired,
but the twin. These are all very familiar, so they never quite escape.
No, they are indeed familiar, and those happen to be details from my own biography. There, of course, one wants to stop, because if I find myself writing about another writer, which is probably not a good idea in the first place, then I will, as with the writer protagonist of the Tidewater Tales, make him as different from myself as I can while sharing a few biographical features. The protagonist of that big fat novel, The Tidewater Tales, is an arch minimalist writer who has become so minimalist that he has reached silence. This chap is not a fiction writer, though he's tried his hand at it and failed. He's a new journalist who writes about his own adventures speaks of himself in the third person. The attitude that I like best, my attitude to this matter, was expressed best by Vladimir Nabokov in an interview in which he said that he too deplores autobiographical fiction, but that from time to time he'll bestow on one of his characters a detail from his own biography as one might award a medal. And some of my characters have purple hearts and good conduct medals, hash marks, bad conduct medals, etc.
Well, having autobiographical touches not only makes it easier, too, to a certain degree, it kind of makes it more interesting. I mean, everybody's wants to talk about himself and but, write about himself.
But
degree.
That kind of interest is the kind that makes me creep in my chair, and that's a kind of a spooky, almost prurient interest, which I quite understand, because when I'm reading the works of my friends, I look for these little signals from the author behind the figure as well. And yet, that kind of curiosity is as illegitimate in its way, I think, as the sort of spooky, even bizarre, accidental relevance, topicality that the book has picked up from recent history. I mean, so much of his action takes place in the Persian Gulf and in Basra and Baghdad, but it was written back in the days when Saddam was our friend. And anyway, my Baghdad is not that Baghdad. But it robs the bank of human experience, and I think it deprecates in an objectionable fashion the quality of authorial invention to look too much, even in the work of writers who we know work very close to the autobiographical bone when they're making fiction, to regard those things as autobiography. The difference, obvious to yourself, of course, because you're a professional at literature, the difference may not go without saying for a lot of readers. If your name is Philip Roth, say, I was just speaking of this with another person, and if you write a book which is fiction, in which the hero's name is Philip, and he has a life very like Philip Roth's, let's say, his life has followed much of the same trajectory and curve and so forth, but you're representing the book as fiction, there's an enormous difference between that and a memoir. And simply speaking, the difference is this, that fiction has to make its point and have its validity as though everything in it were invented out of the whole cloth, even when we know that it doesn't. So the question of so what, of why are you telling us this, the answer to that question must never be in a novel, because that's the way it was. I think Roth answered one time to the question, how come you call this guy Philip? I like the name. that's exactly right. If we have a character in Dante's Divine Comedy who happens to be named Dante, and he's wandering around being called Dante, etc., or in Borges's fiction, a guy named Borges, in Isaac Babel's fiction, we have a character like who's named Isaac Babel, riding with the Cossacks, as Babel did. The difference between that and an actual memoir is enormous, because we will not say ever that this chap is named Philip because the author happens to be named. He's named Philip because that's an appropriate name for a character in this situation. It's part of the imaginative fabric. This is what makes, I think, most of us, when we're asked about the autobiographical allusions or details in the fiction, makes us fidget a little bit, because it's impoverishing the forces of invention and imagination and our sense of what's relevant as art rather than relevant as People magazine gossip.
Yeah, but one's art doesn't come out of thin air. You grab onto things, whether it's your life or the lives of other people. But at the same time, I don't believe a fiction writer is under any obligation to explain his work.
No, I mean, he, she has had the say on the page, and probably shouldn't go nattering on about it, though here we are nattering. After all, we like to talk about books as well as write books, most of us.
Maybe you can clear up something. This phrase has been, I've heard this year after year, and I've talked to people like Hoover, I've talked to Gass, I've talked to John Gardner, who at that time was feuding with Gass, and this is this term, postmodernist. Mm-hmm. Now, that's also been applied to you, and it's like, there are all sorts of terms I don't understand, but that's certainly one literary term I've never quite grasped, except that there is a school of, I don't hate to say school, there's a group of people who tend to use words playfully. And is that postmodernism?
Well, it's one of maybe nine field identification marks of postmodernism. And I guess as with other artistic phenomena, not just artistic phenomena, any 7 out of 9 would qualify this bird as a chickadee, let's say.
That sounds like a made-up word that somebody on a college campus just created for a textbook.
Well, like post-impressionism, it has this sort of limp feeling that it's the thing that comes in after the main show has exited. It's the thing that comes after something else. And of those writers you just mentioned and others who are often thrown into the same bag, it's important to remember a couple of things. One is that such labels, romantic, realist, fantast, magical realist, modernist, postmodernist, etc., are just more or less useful terms. We can't talk without nouns like that. We say, you know, what do you call that building? Well, that's late modern. This is postmodern. This restaurant is upscale. This one is, etc.
Postmodern means after modern.
Whatever else it is and isn't, it's a thing that comes after modern. Then, of course, all the roads divide. And of the writers you named, I may be the only one who will acknowledge to being a postmodernist.
A modern writer would...
Modernist, let's say, just to keep, because modern seems to mean just now.
A modern writer might be construed to be someone like Hemingway or Fitzgerald. So a postmodernist would be a writer who comes after those great writers?
Who comes after those great writers and after the Romantic movement out of which modernism comes. And I have several sort of pet ways of distinguishing the phenomena. In architecture, it's always easy, at least if you're a writer. It's always easy to look at buildings and say this one's postmodernist because you can see the ironic quotations of the Victorian up there on top of the whatever high rise that's set. In painting, for us writers, it seems it's not all that difficult to distinguish the abstract expressionist, let's say, and the other varieties of modernist painting from certain postmodernists like David Hockney and Lucian Freud and so forth. With literature, it's a little fishier, but so is modernism a little fishier to apply. Here are some of my ideas. I like the remark that Umberto Eco made in his book on postmodernism and other things. He says the postmodern condition for a writer is that of a man who is passionately in love with a woman, and he wants to, he's an Italian, it could have been the woman passionately in love with a man, and who wants to say to her, I love you madly, but he can't do that because he knows, and he knows that she knows, that these words have already been worn out by Barbara Cartland. So what does he do then? He may say, as Barbara Cartland would say, I love you madly. In other words, he has put an ironic spin on the situation, as Eco says in a nice way, they are playing the game of irony, but at the same time, a passionate declaration of love has been made, but it's not an innocent one, and it's made in full awareness of and responsibility to the already said. That's the operative remark in that episode. The postmodernist writer, not that the modernists didn't have some of these characteristics, but the postmodernist writer, by my definition, if it's going to be something worth paying attention to, is a writer who, A, does try to keep one foot in the high-tech present and one foot in the ancient narrative past, which is a way of acknowledging the already said, and who, B, is trying to do something fresh and new and even passionate and perhaps comic, but doing it with a kind full responsibility to the thousands of generations of his or her predecessors, to try to make it new in the face of the almost intimidating exhaustiveness of what's already been done. That may very well lead to irony. I don't think it requires irony, but it may lead to ironic quotation. But the end, if we're talking about writing worth reading, the end is the famous end of all old storytelling, to speak of, as Aristotle says, human life, its happiness and its misery, as well as the human experience of language and of literature. Artists learn from other art and from dealing with language as well as learning from life.
I think other people like you around who explain these things to readers.
Any further questions?
The rest of us just read, you know. We don't know what we're reading, but now we could get an explanation about it.
Well, you know, it's the critics who lay these labels on, and you find yourself, and people who are as old as I am, and those other chaps, my compatriots whom you mentioned, have had the interesting experience of in the 50s being called black humorists, and in the maybe provincial American existentialists.
New journalists?
In the 60s, we were all called fabulists, you know, and then lately we've been called postmodernists. So if we have a kind of theoretical turn of mind, as well as just telling stories, we may become curious about these labels that we find being laid on us and attempt to understand what it is that's going on in our shop that leads people to classify us together, to categorize us together, when among ourselves we may feel that the differences are enormously more significant and important than the similarities.
You started out wanting to be a musician, and you've come kind of far afield from that, but is music still a good part of your life?
Well, my ambition as a musician, back when I had that ambition and came up to Juilliard from high school, though I played jazz drums, was not to be a performer, but to be an orchestrator. And I've felt that that is my strongest suit, and at least it's the thing I most enjoy doing as a writer. I like to take a received melody, let's say, like Sinbad's Voyages, or the traditional stories of young Americans losing their innocence and going through the initiation rituals of puberty, marriage, divorce, peaking of career, loss of middle-aged innocence, etc., and then reorchestrate them to my purposes. So there is a kind of ongoing career as an orchestrator, I think, that can be traced through my work as a writer.
I can see you as a drummer. I think you'd be a terrific drummer today.
Though the rhythms of jazz do not come up in the cadences of English prose all that often, I think.
You could have one of these synthesizers, you know, you could take out on the boat, you know, a Yamaha of some kind.
My synthesizer is in the back of my imagination, and it synthesizes Sinbad and Simon Baylor and Perseus and Bellerophon and all sorts of other people whom I have never been.
You won the National Book Award for Chimera. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I would say Chimera.
Chimera. Tell me a little bit about... I follow very closely the awards. In fact, Charles Johnson, who won the National Book Award, was supposed to be here today.
Deservedly so.
Yeah, I read his book. It was a wonderful book, a lot shorter than yours.
Yes.
He was supposed to be here today, in fact, and he canceled. I hope to talk to him later because his...
I don't mind playing second fiddle to Charles.
No, he was supposed to be in earlier today.
Oh.
He canceled, but he's going to come back because his book is coming out in paperback. You both won that same award. I just wonder, it seems to me unfair in a way, not that you don't deserve it or he didn't deserve it, but books are so dissimilar that to say this is the book of the year seems to me...
Isn't it strange?
Yeah.
And we don't have in the United States what they have in certain other civilized countries, a large variety of literary prizes, so that this one is usually awarded. Let's say we need a prize for best realist novel of the year, best fantastical novel, best postmodern novel of the year. They have these things in France and Italy, where if you get the Strega, it doesn't mean the same thing as if you got the Feltrinelli, etc. We have a few, and God knows everyone understands the capriciousness and ephemerality and the rest of literary awards. So much so that when I won the National Book Award some years ago, I was moved to say that my definition of a worthwhile literary prize is one that at least now and then will be awarded to an author, despite the fact that he or she happens to deserve it. By that definition, I think the National Book Award and the Nobel Prize, for that matter, and the Pulitzer and the rest are worthwhile literary prizes. It's sort of fun to have those things around, and it makes me uncomfortable when writers sniff at them, because capricious as they are, ephemeral as they are, one should not sniff at them until one has won them all. I think that about PhDs and such too. You know, you should get your PhD and say, PhDs. I feel that way about people who say, as Flaubert is reported to have done, that it's not important to read a lot of books. The important thing is to have read five or six books well. But I believe that one is entitled to say that only after one has, like Flaubert, read bloody all of them, you know. And then you can say, it's like saying, who needs to be outside New York? You know, it's enough to be in New York. You don't need to say that after you've seen the rest of the globe.
But the awards are good in at least one respect. Not only is it good for the ego of the writer, but it's good for the industry, and it creates some publicity and awareness of it's not quite like the Booker. I understand they even broadcast the Booker Awards live in England. You know, it's kind of like the Oscars.
That's right, and everybody knows the short lists year after year after year.
The bookmakers take bets on the.
Well, this is the unpleasant side of it. There is that egregious fact that. That books are, as you quite justly say, so different from one another that it's always apples and oranges. And God help the poor jurors if they're trying to do their job honestly and don't have some private agenda that they want to promote. And I think most book judges try to be as open-minded as human beings can in these matters, to try to sort out these apples and oranges and say, in the case, if we have a good, bountiful literary year in America, I've seen instances where every one of the candidates, every one of the nominees, seem to me to deserve the prize.
Have you been on an awards panel of any kind?
I have always refused to do two things, at least in the literary world. One is to adjudicate my fellow writers by being a panel judge. The other is to adjudicate them by writing a book review. I know writers, I honor writers who do this. No reason why they shouldn't sound off and make their opinions known. But my vows to the muse, which I made early on in the game, prohibit me from doing either of those two things.
Well, John Barth, we're out of time. I know you're going up to Endicott. Is that where you're reading tonight?
Yes, to read to a live audience instead of just a living one.
That's a beautiful bookstore, too.
Yes,
it's up
it
in
is.
My neighborhood. And, well, it's been 8 years. I'm glad we had a chance to spend the past 45 minutes together and talk about your work. I thought this was a very funny and often moving book, and I thank you very, very much for coming in and talking to me.
Quite welcome, Don. My pleasure.